Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar, where we sit down and talk with interesting professional guitar players and other musicians, uncover their life stories, and discover what makes them tick. If you love guitar, music, and the backstory of people's lives, then stick around. You're in the right place. Support the show and get your Everyone Loves Guitar t-shirts, hoodies, and mugs at guitarmerch.com, where you'll also find other cool music and guitar t-shirts. That's guitarmerch.com. Hey, everybody. This is Craig Garber. Welcome to Everyone Loves Guitar. Man, I'm so excited today. I've got such a brilliant artist and a lovely person. We're with the one and only Joan Armatrading. Everybody's heard of Joan. Just give you the quick cliff note summary. Three-time Grammy-nominated British singer-songwriter. First UK female singer-songwriter to gain international success. First female UK artist to debut at number one in Billboard's blues charts. First female UK artist to be nominated for a Grammy in the blues category. She's also got one of the coolest opening lines in a song, her song Love and Affection from her third album, 1976. That album is just called Joan Armatrading. The line is, I am not in love, but I'm open to persuasion. That is a very teasing line there, Joan. in a recording career spanning 46 years, she's released 19 studio records as well as several live and compilation albums. Joan, thanks so much for your time. I really appreciate you coming on the show.
My pleasure, Craig. I think it might be 21 studio albums.
But 21 studio albums. Awesome.
I think it might be. These 21 albums that are kind of not live albums.
It's just amazing.
I think it's 21.
Just on that subject, how do you, I had a question about this, but how do you, your catalog is so deep. Is it a challenge to, you know, like when you're a guitar player, not play the same riffs, right? Is it a challenge as a writer to not write the same, either the exact same concepts of the song or the same melodies? Is that difficult?
Well, the thing about being alive with people is that there's lots of people, there's lots of different people. And although we're all going through an experience that's very similar, for instance, if you had 10 people and they saw an accident and the police came along and they said, okay, what did you see? Those 10 people would tell you something slightly different. Then some people would tell you what the person was wearing. Somebody would tell you where they were positioned. Somebody would tell you the height of the person. Somebody would tell you if they were with somebody else or they were on their own. Everybody would tell you something slightly different, even though they're all seeing the same accident. And that's really how songwriting goes. When you're writing about love, everybody experiences love in a very different way.
Yeah.
And so you're able to say, I love you, but I hate you really. Or I love you, you're my life. I could, as somebody would say, I'd die for you. I mean, there's so many ways that people are going to express this thing of love. So although it's the same thing you're writing about, it's always going to have something different to it.
That's really cool. But you said something really short in there in the beginning that I say all the time, and I agree with you. We're not all that different.
No, we're not.
No, maybe you got like, I don't know what the number is, 8 categories of people or, you know, big giant categories, but everybody, we're pretty similar within those boxes. You know, you have differences and of course different thoughts and, well, like you said, the way you perceive things, but I don't think people are all that different really.
No, they're not all that different, and everybody's looking for a very similar experience in terms of how people react to them and treat them, feel about them. And I always think sometimes you look at people and they're criminals, they're really, really bad people. But if you hear them talk about a parent, then they become this really good person.
Yeah.
It's quite incredible. And they want that love that everybody else wants from their parents. Or if they don't have that love for their parent, there's going to be a friend that they love. It's very rare, because I watch a lot of those type of programs, and it's very rare to see a criminal who is completely and utterly selfish.
Right.
Like completely, like has no regard for literally anybody on earth. There's right. always this one person that they think the world of.
Yeah.
You look at what was the girl, the monster girl?
Aileen Wuornos?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, yeah. You look at her and she's there, she's killing all these guys, but she's totally in love with this woman who she'd do anything for.
Yeah.
And the womona, I suppose, would do anything for her. And she doesn't think, well, let me kill her.
Right, right. You know,
she just thinks, let me do everything for her. And you get people like that, you know. You get people, if you look at, what's his name, Bundy, same thing. There's always somebody that they have this affinity with. So we're all looking for the same thing.
Yeah, no love, acceptance.
We're all looking for the same thing.
Yeah.
And that's why sometimes I find it quite difficult to know why some things just escalate to this other world.
Yeah.
Because even when they go to this other world, they're still looking for this kind of special relationship thing. It's so strange.
Yeah, I have these conversations with my wife sometimes too. It's like, I don't know. I think when power gets involved, that's when things sort of go south, you know, and there is an agenda, and that's that's kind of corrupts everything.
Yeah.
Hey, if what I read online is accurate, and if it's not, please tell me, the first song that you ever played in public was The Sounds of Silence by Simon and Garfunkel. Is that correct?
I think it was that. I'm pretty sure it was that. I started writing songs when I was about 13, 14.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
When I was to do this first concert, because I only had the songs that I wrote, I didn't start off by learning other people's. I just started off by writing my songs. And so because, you know, I was told, well, you people might need to know something that you're singing. So I thought, well, I'll learn that and just play that. So that was in the repertoire of all my songs.
That's a beautiful song. That's like literally one of my favorite songs. You know, their early, well, the whole catalog is great, but you know, that early stuff was really beautiful. What made you pick that song? What about it?
I don't know. I mean, it was a nice song. I could have picked something else. I don't know. I just had to pick something. You know that great joke of the policeman, and this woman is standing at the side of the road, and a policeman goes up and stands by her, and she says, "Officer, what have I done? I didn't realize I was doing it." And he says, "Madam, I have to stand somewhere."
So you had to pick something.
Madam,
I had to stand some. That's such a British thing. Like, you know, that's like British humor. If you said that in America, people would be like, "What?" That's funny. What you said something too, that you started writing at 13 and 14. You didn't do covers. Yes. That's really unusual. What prompted you to go down that path? That's really courageous, to be honest with you.
Well, I wasn't thinking courageous. I always say, and I'm absolutely sure this is the case, I was born to write. This is why I'm here. I'm very happy to know why I'm on this earth. And my father used to play the guitar, but he would never really play it in front of me, and he would hide the guitar. He hid it in this top shelf thing in this room that the door was too heavy for a young person to open. And just didn't want me to touch that guitar. And I think just not being able to do it made me want to do it.
Yeah, they don't know. They're not thinking.
Yes, and I saw an old guitar in a pawn shop. You would call it, secondhand shop.
Yeah, pawn shop. They had,
pawn
yeah,
shop.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I saw that in there, and I said to my mom, can I have it? She said she didn't think I could because it cost £3.
Oh my God!
I don't know what the £3 is in US.
$4.50.
Yeah, something like silly. Anyway, she didn't have that money, but she said, "I've got two old prams, strollers. If they would swap those two strollers for the guitar, you could have it." So that's how I got my first guitar.
That's cool.
And my mother also decided that she would get a piano in the front room, just because she thought it was a great piece of furniture, just liked the look of it. She picked out the wall that it would go on. And literally, as soon as the piano arrived, I started writing songs.
Wow. So you just had this inside of you then?
It was just inside of me. It wasn't cool. Because, you know, and I, as I say, I didn't learn other people's things. And I used to write before I started writing lyrics. I used to write limericks, which was funny verses.
Yeah.
And as soon as the piano arrived and I started to write the songs, then I just wrote lyrics, not limericks.
That's very cool.
So it was just, and I used to write, you know, funny little stories and, you know, things like that. So, and I read a lot, you know, I read a lot of Shakespeare and Dickens and Enid Blyton and all the children's stuff. And I was just really into going to the library all the time and just reading stuff. And I was really into the words, especially how Dickens and Shakespeare write, you know. And I read Agatha Christie as well. And I was just into it. And I think all of those things made me appreciate words.
So you actually studied writing in your own way by learning, by reading all these things and processing everything and absorbing it.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't know that that's what I was doing.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
I didn't consciously sit down to do that, but it certainly was something that influenced what I was doing when I was writing. Cause I would write the words in a way. When I sing them, they sound as if they're rhyming, but I'm not really interested in rhyming. I'm interested in telling a story most of the time, and I don't think, you know, will moon rhyme with June. I'm not really
sure.
Concerned about that, but I'm concerned that when you read the lyrics away from the music, you can get something from them.
Yeah, and your lyrics all read like that, very much so, very very much so. What was your first big break in the music business?
First big break. Well, look, the first big break would obviously be getting my first contract. And that was funny as well, because when I took the songs to the different record companies, I actually got given a recording contract by everybody. Everybody said, okay, have it. And I know that's not the norm, but that's kind of what happened. And then I ended up choosing the one to stay with. And the process of that was quite easy. Once you have your contract, then it's hard work because you've got to make the record. That wasn't for me hard because I loved writing and recording and all that stuff. But you have to do lots of interviews and you have to be on stage. And I was incredibly shy, like really seriously shy. So that was hard for me to do, but I wanted people to know the songs, so I was willing to kind of deal with the shyness to get people to know the songs. So that was the big break. The big break was getting that first recording contract.
Are you still shy, like by nature, or are you more open?
By nature, no. By nature, I'm very shy, but because I've been doing this for so long, and I'm. Especially as more and more as my career developed, I had to be the one to put people at ease rather than the other way around.
Yeah.
You end up kind of having to get over it so that you can, otherwise you just be standing there a couple of idiots, nobody's saying anything, you know, so you have to. And I remember seeing, I won't mention who it is, but I remember seeing somebody once who is incredibly famous, much more famous than I am. And he was talking to somebody, or they were talking to him, and he was being really seriously shy. And he'd been in the business for a long, long time, very, very famous, playing stadium, you know, all that stuff. And I thought, yeah, you're having a laugh. That's an act. I know how shy I was, and there's no way you can still, you know, in certain instances, it could be there, and I can't kind of control it. But if you're talking to a fan and stuff, the shyness might be there, but you still have the conversation. You still, you know, it's you can't, as I say, you can't do that, because people would come up to you and they'd be thinking, oh, I'm meeting whoever it is.
Right.
And I've got to say the right thing. And then they're all a bit flustered. So if you're both a bit flustered and you're both not really communicating well, somebody's got to be able to do it.
So you realize you're gonna have to be the one to lead.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so you just learned how to get out of that.
That's right.
I'll give you credit. That's tough. And I have interviewed so many people that are inherently shy, and the process has been somewhat similar to get out of the comfort zone.
Yeah.
You've accomplished so much, but I also know, you know, it's weird. You know all this so much better than what I'm going to say, but it's really weird how I've never been a guy that gets like starstruck. Because I know we're all the same, like, you know, somebody may do a certain talent at a high level, but, you know, they still worry about, you know, their kids don't listen to them. Yeah. They got bills to pay, you know, their relationship, you know, we're all the same. So I know the accolades and what society considers successful isn't always necessarily the things that mean the most to you. And I was curious, what are the things that you're, you know, proudest of whenever, you know, musically or otherwise, or that give you sort of the, you know, a sense of warmth or nostalgia about the things you've done to the extent you're comfortable sharing them?
Well, I'm very proud of being able to write songs that people want to connect to and with and want to express themselves to others via. You know, that's quite an incredible thing to have somebody say, I did an interview with this chap in, I think it was Vienna, who said, after we finish this interview, I'm going to propose to my girlfriend with your music.
Whoa. That's a lot of responsibility there.
I know, but, you know, you're not going to get better than that.
That is so, pretty freaking cool, Joan. Yeah, wow.
That's very cool. And you get people, they get married to your music, they name their children after your songs, they bring their children to, I mean, all of those things, they bring their children to the concert and the children become fans, not because they were forced to become fans, but because they fell in love with the music as well. All those things are things that make you feel really warm and fuzzy.
Yeah, that's heavy.
It's a wonderful thing. And I think, I'm saying it for myself, but I would say any songwriter who gets that kind of connection would have that same feeling, because it's not everybody who can do that.
Yeah.
It's great. But I also say that while you're thinking that you're so special, you know, you're actually not so special, because there's a song called The Birdie Song. Do you know that song?
I don't. I'm sorry.
It's a very kind of, I might say, flippant novelty record. But there's loads and loads of people who love that record. It was a big hit in the UK, and loads of people. And I remember saying this to a journalist, that you have to respect that, because there's going to be people who that's their song.
Yeah.
And she said, yes, a friend of hers has that stuck up on her fridge door, because that's how she met her husband.
Wow.
Through the birdie song. You've got to kind of respect all the things that are there for people to enjoy.
So the thing that means the most to you is your ability to basically put out the positive vibes that other people hang on to and connect with.
That, absolutely. Yeah. Songwriting is incredibly important to me. But the other thing that I'm really seriously proud about is when I got my degree, I got a history degree, a BA honours degree, and I did that at the Open University. So I did my all my exams and all my papers while I was on tour, and I had to do the exams when I got back to England.
As if you didn't have enough to do while you're on tour, I guess, right? Let me get a degree. That is pretty.
I'm very proud of that, though. I got that, and then when I went to get my degree, I was with all the other people who
That's cool.
spent all their time, and you know, so it was great. It wasn't, and I've got lots of honorary degrees. I'm very proud of those, but nothing can beat working really hard, doing all the papers that you're supposed to do, and sitting all the exams that you're supposed to sit, and actually getting the paper that says, yeah, you did all right.
Congratulations. That is pretty cool. That is really cool. As a singer-songwriter, many times it's just you and a guitar, and you know, that's a very vulnerable position to be in when you add to the fact that on top of that, you're singing songs about feelings you've had, especially you write a lot of love songs. When did you get to the point where you're able to do that and you're not thinking about the vulnerability, you're just thinking about your message you want to deliver? Or did that come early, naturally?
That came naturally and very early, because from very early, I didn't really write stuff about myself. Of course, there were songs that are written about me, but the most of the songs are written from looking at other people, something I've seen personally, something somebody's told me, something I've read, something I've seen on the television, something I've watched people go through, and I write about them. But my style of writing implies that it's all about me.
So you're a storyteller more than anything.
I'm a storyteller, yeah.
You know, I had read that, and I didn't, to be 100% honest with you, I didn't know if the answer that you gave was like, like somebody was asking you a stupid question and that was dismissive. But, you know, in hearing you now, I know it's sincere. That's really interesting. Yeah. Really interesting.
There's a song, and I'll give, well, the, a couple of songs I can tell you how they, well, I can tell you more than a couple, but one one is a song called Everyday Boy, which is about a chap who had AIDS. Wow. And I was invited to have some dinner with some friends and met him there. And he was telling everybody, not just me, telling everybody the story of his boyfriend's mother, who was being really horrible to him, because she thought her son would automatically die because they were together.
Right.
And he was telling that story in such a compassionate, caring, understanding way. I just thought he was great. And I just watched him do certain things, like he went to the mirror and did his hair and stuff like that. And I just wrote about what I saw. And as he was telling the story, I was completely engaged. But I could feel the song forming as he was telling the story. And as soon as I got home, I wrote the words down and wrote the song. And so that's that. He actually did die, and they played, it's a song called Everyday Boy, and they played that at his memorial. And then there's another song that I wrote called The Shouting Stage. And I wrote that because I was in Australia. I was in this restaurant, and this man and this woman were having this big argument. And the restaurant's there, and they're doing all this stuff, and the chap gets up and he charges out of the room, and then the woman's all in tears, you know, she's all crying and very kind of emotional. And I just thought to myself, I wonder what got them to the shouting stage. Because what made them get to that point? Because they're out. They're in public. So that's how I got that. Down to Zero was written because there were two people that I knew who were both breaking up with their boyfriends at the same time, two girls. Mm-hmm. And the both of the girls did the same thing. They both kind of said, well, I'm so beautiful. How can you possibly leave me? that's what Down to Zero is because of those two.
That's really cool. I like that, the shouting stage. Is that just a curiosity? Yeah, you know, I talked to Anne, you know, my wife, and it's really funny because she knows she's been here like 30 years. So sometimes she says things and I'm like, she's like, well, in England, they wouldn't do that. And I'm thinking, come on, babe, that you left England 30 years ago. It's got to change. So let me ask you a question. Would you see stuff like that going on in England, like a couple screaming like lunatics at each other in a cafe or something?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that's what I thought, because she would be horrified seeing that. And she'd she'd say, oh, you know, that they wouldn't go. That's what I thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been on a train. I remember being on a train once and seeing I don't really want to say, but I saw this chap being physical with his wife, or his girlfriend. I don't know. And the police had to come, and you know, it was not great. Yeah. And he's on a train, so it's even more confined, if you like, than a restaurant or cafe or whatever.
And you're thinking, so, if he's like that on a train, God knows what's going on at home. That's the problem.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly what everybody was thinking. And we, you know, people were trying to come to her aid and so on. But the police came anyway. The train got stopped and the police came.
Well, next time my wife says they don't do that, I'll say, bullshit, Joan Armatrade sorted me out. In 2007, you released Into the Blues, and great, wonderful record. And except for drums, you played all the instruments on it. Some great guitar work on your part in there. And my favorite songs in there are Deep Down, Empty Highway, and Something's Gotta Blow. And the whole, what a great song, because you feel the whole time musically, something's going to blow. You know, the way you did that, it was really cool. You had to feel great when that came out and went to number one on the blues charts, right?
That was fantastic. I'm telling you how I wrote Something's Gotta Blow. It was written because I had to go on the tube. And that day, they kind of cancelled, like, loads of trains, and the tubes were packed and the trains were packed, and it was all horrible. And it was hot, and you could feel everybody like about to explode. It was people were very frustrated, and you got onto, you know, when you see those things in Japan where they're pushing the people onto the tube. It was kind of that stuff, trying to get people onto the train, and so you had that on the tube, but then when you had to go to the overground train, it was a similar thing because of all these cancellations. When a train came, everybody was trying to get onto that train. And it was chaos. It was so glad to get home and away from it. But it was very, and in the song I talk about rustling of packets of stuff and smell of food and all that. All of that stuff was going on. It was all right there in your nose, you know, it's all this horrible food smell and crunchy eating.
Oh, yeah. People are, hey, I grew up in New York City. You're preaching to the choir. I've been on some nasty trains, trust me.
It was all of that, and it was so kind of visual, and you could kind of feel it. And I had to write something like that because that was just too powerful to not write something about it.
It's very cool. So, like, is it safe to say if you want to write something, like, you just go out and start living, or just getting in the middle of people somewhere?
I don't deliberately go to look for something to write, but you know, if you're around and as a writer you're an observer, and because I tend to sort of notice things. I often say the thing about the shouting stage. The restaurant had loads of people in it, but I can guarantee I'm the only one that went and wrote a song about it.
Oh God, yeah.
It's not that the other people didn't see it, but they're not thinking in those terms. And another thing that I really like to say about is Mark Knopfler, because it's the same thing for him. He's an observer. He's looking at things, and these things will kind of bring up these words that he's got to put on paper. But when he wrote Money for Nothing, that was being in that shop and watching the guy who was watching, he's a worker in the shop, and he was watching the television, and he says, look at them working, that's money for nothing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's how it works.
It's so cool.
He's got his mind and his attention and everything open, and he's present, and he's thinking, yeah, they're saying that, I've got that.
Wow. So let me ask you this. There's a certain awareness that people like yourself, people that are really tuned to their what's going on around them, in a way beyond just watching.
Yes.
I'm like that, to be honest with you, because I understand that. I'm not thinking about it to write, but it's important and has always been important to me to have that awareness and just, you know, to have your antennas up kind of.
Yeah.
To the extent you're comfortable, what makes you like that? What do you think that you have that?
I don't know, because this is how I've always been. I've always been, you know, when I was at school and I was in the playground, of course I played like everybody else, but I would be quite interested to see how everybody else was playing. So even at that young age, I was quite interested in watching how people were with each other. So I think it's just something, I've no idea really. I've no idea why.
Yeah, because and then you've taken that and you have a gift and you've turned, you know, it's almost like you've honored that.
Yes, it's your job. Yeah. If you're given a talent, it's your job to respect it and to use it.
Yeah, that's really cool. I just got goosebumps when you said that. That's really cool. Yeah.
Yes, but it's true. If you're given a talent, it's your job to make use of it and to do with it what it's supposed to be. What it's intended for. And one of the saddest thing, and I've seen it, is to see somebody who has a talent and they do nothing with it. It's very sad to watch.
Yeah, there's an express, you know, I think there's an American football player named Gale Sayers here. They made a movie of his life, which I'm having a brain fart. He died of cancer, really moving. But he had this expression. He said, motivation without opportunity is a shame, but opportunity without motivation is a waste.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what you're saying. And I agree with you.
Yeah.
I totally agree with that. Yeah. Into the Blues, what were some of the challenges of making that record? And what were some of the feelings you had, excuse me, about the success of it? And also, it sounded like you're playing a Strat on most of that. Is that correct?
Yeah, something. Like a Strat. Yeah.
Beautiful.
When I, up until I did that album, when I wrote, I would write whatever came into my head. So if I felt like it was a blues song, I would write a blues song. If I felt the next one was a jazz song, it'd be a jazz song. If it was a pop song, it'd be a pop song. A little country song. So when I wrote, whatever came into my head, I just did. With Into the Blues, I decided that, I think after I made the last album, the album before that is, I decided that I wanted to do something in a different way. And I thought, let me see if I can stick to one genre.
Yeah, that's tough.
Let's see if I can do that, because I'm not used to doing it. And so when I did that, and then I thought, I'll do a trilogy of that. So straight away, I decided to do the trilogy of blues, rock, jazz.
It's funny, you're like so... I appreciate your work ethic, because you have a whole concept, you know, like with this whole trilogy. Like most people would just, you know, say, okay, I'm going to do a blues record, but you already had it laid out. Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that kind of work ethic. It's really cool. Yeah. Sorry.
I had to really kind of rein myself in when I was doing it, because I started off and I did the first one and then I almost went off into something else. I thought, no, this is what you're doing, and kind of had to just every now and again just remind myself of what I was doing. So that first one was the hardest, if you like. Once I was writing the song, I'm there, it's easy. But it's just that mentally to remember what you were trying to do. So that was quite hard, quite challenging. But I really, really enjoyed doing it, loved doing it, loved playing it. And I think probably people thought if I was doing a blues album that, although I didn't say to people, this is what I'm doing, but once they knew it was going to be a blues album which coming out, they probably might think I was doing covers or blues, but you know, the blues are done in the way that I write.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was people talked to that album. I was really, really, really pleased.
It's a great record.
Accepted it. Yeah,
it's a great record. Some great blues on there. Your guitar playing was pretty different on that than on a lot of the other records. You know, you really like stepped up and played some kick-ass blues guitar.
Yeah, there's this album of mine called What's Inside, and there's a song called Lost to Love, and I'm playing the guitar on that, and the record company did a focus groups thing, and they asked everybody who's playing the guitar, who's playing the solo. Nobody mentioned me. They mentioned just about every other male guitarist.
So when you wrote that record, as you were sitting, observing, knowing that you're in this mode, did you sort of have to put on the like blues lenses in a sense to see each situation from a blues
Yes. You had to if you're writing a pop song, the way pop lyrics go, they kind of go like pop lyrics. So if you want it to be blues, you don't write a pop lyric, or you don't write a jazz lyric, or you don't write a country lyric. They all have the cliche way of, but other, I mean, cliches sound as if it's a negative thing, but it's not. A cliche is something that allows you to know what that thing is.
Sure, sure.
If you write rock and roll, you need those cliches in rock and roll to let you know it's rock and roll.
Yes.
And if you're a cordon bleu cook, you need to do those cliches of how you put that dish together for you to know that this is what it is. If you don't have that, then you don't know where you are.
Yes.
So in order to make the blues thing, I had to make sure that I did some of those cliched things, albeit sometimes in my way, but you knew that it was blues.
Yeah.
Even if you listen to a song like Secular Songs, I think that's on there, it's still got a blues thing to it. It's slightly out of it, but it's still got that blues thing to it. So, you've got to try and rein in how you're writing the words, how you're putting the music together, the melody together, and definitely how you play the guitar.
Great record.
That's very, very important.
Really cool record. Everybody listening, check it out, Into the Blues. What were some of the low points or the dark periods that you've had to deal with in life, and how'd you get through them? Again, whatever you're comfortable.
In life, I don't have a load of dark points, really.
That's freaking amazing.
It's not that I've never been sad or whatever, but I tend to be quite an optimistic person. I tend to see the positive in most things. Even if something hasn't gone quite right, I think, okay, well, there's a reason for that, and this will come out of that. So I'm not really into regrets and why didn't that work out. I don't really get into that.
Yeah, well, that's a hard once you start doing the why, and you've, at least speaking for myself, you feel like a victim. And if you're a driven person, that is not a place that people that are, you know, driven want to go or even remotely touch.
No, you want to just get on with life and enjoying it. You don't want to spend time looking for revenge or looking for why this didn't work or looking to talk people down or whatever. That none of those things are worth any kind of energy.
Yes.
You need all your energy for good stuff.
Good stuff.
Good stuff for yourself and good stuff for those around you. That's what you need your energy for.
Yeah, that's cool. Any advice if you had to go back and tell younger Joan something that would have made your life easier? Anything you would have told yourself?
Yeah, it'd be all right.
<That's> very British. It'll be all right. Hey, let's talk about gear for a few minutes. What's your go-to guitar right now? Has that changed over the years? And both acoustic and electric.
It's changed. When I did the last album, which came out in 2018, it's called Not Too Far Away. Mm-hmm. I decided on that album that it would be just acoustic guitar. And I also decided, and I've been playing Ovations since 75 or whatever it was.
Wow, that's a long time.
It might even be before 75, actually. I think it was before 75. Anyway, I've been playing it since forever, and on record and on stage and everything. But when I decided that this last record was going to be acoustic, there's one song that's got some electric on it, I decided that I would play a Martin.
Oh, okay.
So I got a couple of Martin guitars. And that was really nice because when I write on guitar or piano, and I use different guitars because different guitars make you do different things.
Yeah.
They feel different. They sound different. Your brain reacts differently to them. So when I write, I'm not just on the same one all the time. But when I did this last album, I was on the same one all the time. It's when you do things differently, you do get different results. And so that's why I change up all the time. Just, you know, I'm the constant. I'm the one that's always there. So I have to do things to make myself interested. So the Martin's the go-to guitar at the moment. I don't know whether it'll remain that, but it was for all making the last album, and I used it on stage as well
for touring the last record.
I just played Martin as well, but I've got Tom Anderson guitars that I love.
Great really guitars,
and on Into the Blues, it's Tom Anderson guitars mainly, the Strat and Tom Anderson guitars.
Those steel frets he puts on there, man, it's like an unfair advantage, isn't it? I mean, it's just
they're brilliant guitars.
Yeah, so nice to play.
I've got a few actually.
What's your favorite song you wrote, and what's your favorite song to play?
That's an impossible question to
really. I know, it's not like you don't have a few to choose from.
My favorite song just to play and sing used to be, and it probably still is, Kissing and Hugging. Because it's one of those songs that you could sing it 10 times in a row and you could sing it different every time. Certain songs you almost are forced to sing it the same way, but Kissing and Hugging, you can really change up. And rhythmically on the guitar, you can change that up as well a lot. So that, it probably still is my favorite song too.
Kissing and Hugging.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
You've had phenomenal musicians. You know, I went back and I looked at each of your personnel on Wikipedia. Yeah. You've had some phenomenal musicians touring and recording with you.
Yeah.
Guitar alone, you've had Davy Johnstone, Jerry Donahue, Ricky Hirsch, our mutual friend, Hiram Bullock, Chris Spedding, who's coming on here soon, Hugh Burns, who's coming on my show soon, Andy Partridge from XTC, Adrian Ballou, Mark Knopfler, and just loads of other talented players. Yeah. Any cool or funny stories you can recall in working with any of these guys?
No, you might ask them that.
Ricky actually said you were very cool to work with. He said you made a comment to him one time where he said something and you turned around and you said something like, "Oh, you're a little cheeky," or something. Something like that. It was like really kind of cute. Do you remember the first record you purchased?
I remember the first record my mom bought for me. There was a woman in England called Gracie Fields. She was a singer and an actress. So that would be in the early 60s or late 50s, maybe. Gracie Fields. And she had a song, I think if I'm not mistaken, the B-side was a song called Little Donkey. But the song that I really liked, the A-side was a Little Donkey, but the side I really liked was a B-side, which had a song on it called Carefree Heart. And in this song, she whistles. And I just love the whole, you know,
that's cool
thing of it, carefree heart, and then she whistles. So that was the first thing that I asked my mom to get for me.
So you're, man, like the vibe I'm getting for you really consistently is your whole thing is, man, you want to put good, just positive stuff out there. Like that's like who you are as a person.
Yeah. I'm very into people being happy. I want to be happy.
Yeah.
And I want everybody to be happy around me. So I'm not interested in any kind of miserable stuff. I like, it's just nice to be positive.
Yeah. Oh God. Yeah. And it's just awful to be like around negative. It's just toxic. Yeah. Have you always been like that? Like,
yes. This so is cool. All I know.
That's wonderful.
All I know.
Desert Island CDs, top three, no particular order, and just for today, because like I know I could ask you that question in an hour, it'll be different.
Just for today?
Yeah, just for this moment, well, actually.
Amy Winehouse would be one. Any one of Amy Winehouse songs, really, from Valerie to Back to Black to doesn't really matter what it is. I love The Killers. So Mr. Bright Eyes, maybe. And I tell you a song that I like. It's not that I'm, and don't be think I'm being horrible, but it's not that I'm necessarily a fan of, I've forgotten her name now. I've just suddenly started to say it. Jordan Sparks. But she's got a song called Battlefield. I really like that song.
What's her name?
Battlefield. It's Jordan Sparks.
Okay.
It?
Yeah.
It was written by that guy. Oh, he writes all those songs and he's in that group. I can't think of his name. But I really like that song. But there's loads of things that I really like. So that go with those for the minute.
That's fair enough. Thank you. What's been for you?
Oh, I tell you what I have as well. Wiz Khalifa, black and yellow.
Wiz Khalifa.
Yeah, black and yellow. That's great.
That's cool.
Yeah.
So, like, how did you're totally like mellow and like very down, you know, very grounded, like you don't seem like you've ever, or maybe you have, but you certainly don't seem like you have any like ego driving you now. And I would imagine someone that has had that, you know, your whole thing is to put positive out there. I would assume that you probably never have had that. What has been the toughest thing for you about being in the limelight? Because that's not necessarily reality of, you know, like that's not, you're clearly not that person. Like, you know, you're not standing on stage 24/7.
Yeah. I don't really feel as if I've been in the limelight. So that's, that takes care of that really. I'm, you know, I love going on stage and performing for the audience because I love the reaction that I get when they hear their favorite song come on and how they, you know, they'll clutch each other and say, oh, she's singing that one. Or you see people in tears, or you see people really laughing, or people really dancing, or all of those things. It's wonderful to be on stage and watch that. But that's being on stage. When you're not on stage, then you're just in the real world. Because in the real world, when you walk into your job, nobody gives you a round of applause.
You
just sit down at your desk and you do your stuff. That's how the world is. So,
yes.
So when you're in that world, you've got to be in that world. Don't expect all this other stuff because that's not natural. That's not how it goes. And there's a limited amount of people who get that. Even though there might seem to be a lot of artists and entertainers and actors and people who get that, there actually isn't. They're not the majority of the people. The majority of the people are just, as I say, just going about their everyday work.
Yeah.
Couple of friends, few friends, head down, do whatever. They're not getting adulation for everything that they do all the time. So you can't live your life like that, because that is not life.
So you've been really cognizant of that and just been yourself, it sounds like, pretty much all throughout this, your whole career.
Yes, but I'm not even trying to do, I'm just doing it, because that's, I am in the real world.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just in the real world. I just know that I'm, you know, I do go on stage, I do write songs. People will recognize me in the street, come and say hello, even if I don't know them, they'll know me. All of that is fine.
Right.
But at the same time, I am, as I say, in the real world.
Yeah.
And you will see people who live life as if they're on stage all the time, and that's got to be weird for them.
I mean, I would think so, because it's tough enough being yourself, you know, to try to like be something else all the time has got to be exhausting. I would think. Yeah. Wow. Tough question. What do you like most about yourself?
What do I like most about myself? I love that I can play the guitar so well. I love that I can play the guitar so well, and I love that I can write songs that people really enjoy. I love that. I'm so happy that I'm able to do those two things.
Man, it sounds like this has like been your mission, and you've done a hell of a job carrying it forth. Honestly, this is, you know, very congruent, extremely congruent with your, you know, who you are in your soul. Flip side, also a tough question. If there's something you could change about yourself, what would that be?
You have to ask somebody if there's something of me that they'd like to be different. Because, you know, if I change too much about myself, then I won't be me, and I'm me mm-hmm. because of all these things that...
I totally get it.
So I don't know that I want to be anything else other than me, so...
Totally get it. You have any hobbies outside of music or interests?
I love walking. I absolutely love going for walks. Whether it's walking in the countryside or walking on a treadmill, I don't care as long as I'm walking.
Sure.
I don't do it as much, but I used to love mountain bike riding. So really enjoy that. But I like all the normal things, you know, gardening. I like watching the television, going to the theater, going to the cinema. I read a lot of comics, whatever comics they are, whether American or British. I've been in the comics myself.
That's so cool. Do you know Basil Brush?
Yeah.
Do you know, and I got, we don't have Basil Brush here, and it was real funny. We had this, when I first met my wife, she told me she used to like this little Basil Brush.
All right.
And so the other day, we're digging stuff out of the house, and this giant box, and she says, apparently I bought her like a box of Basil Brush crap. That was like a British sort of TV comic or just show or something.
No, it was a children's program.
Yeah.
So it was on a children's program.
So I have all this Basil Brush stuff.
That's funny.
Favorite place you've traveled? You've been all over.
I love Italy. My favorite place to play is America. I've said it however many times over the years.
Why is that?
I just love American audiences. There's a kind of an honesty, if you like, about how American audiences react to the thing that they're seeing. And if they're really into it, then they're wild. You know, they let you know they're up, they're shouting, they're whooping, they're wailing. If they don't like it, then they're not doing that thing. Some other places, you might not know exactly how the concert or whatever is going on till the end, and then they go mad. Whereas in America, you kind of know
at every all the stage way where you stand. Yeah.
What's going on? Yeah. So I like traveling in America. I like seeing the different things. America is quite a fascinating country, because in America you can see practically all the sites that you will see in Europe, for instance, or Africa. You know, you'll see a tabletop mountain, or you'll see a particular mountain range or something. You'll see all these different things in America. It's quite interesting. the terrain of that place.
Yeah, we're so big, especially compared to like England or something. Yeah. I forgot to ask you, in 2001, you got the MBE, the Member of the British Empire, from the Queen. Yeah. What was that experience like, and how do you feel about this almost 20 years later?
It was great. It was Prince Charles who gave me my the actual ceremony. It was Prince Charles who gave me my MBE, and I'm a big fan of Prince Charles because I think he does incredible work with the Prince's Trust, and I've been an ambassador, if you like, or sort of certainly a supporter of the Prince's Trust since about 1983. And how he's helped so many young people to get kind of form businesses or just get education or get out of certain toxic situations, and the support that he's given throughout, not just say, okay, here's a bit of money, yeah, now go and see what you can do with it. There's this ongoing support for people, so it's been invaluable what he's done, really. The Prince's Trust is, as I say, one of the charities that I really admire. Another charity that I really admire is a charity called Camfed, who help girls in particular in sub-Saharan Africa. And the person who founded that, Anne Cotton, when she initially went to 25 years ago, when she initially went to one of the countries and saw that the girls weren't being educated, went back to Cambridge in the UK and started to collect money to help them. And 25 years later, she's educated over 3.3 million girls.
Holy smokes. It's quite incredible. That's like over 10,000 women a year.
Yeah.
It's holy smokes.
Yeah, it's amazing what she's done. So Prince Charles gave me the MBE, and I was really happy that it was here. I love the Queen. The Queen is great, but I was really happy that it was Prince Charles.
You know, it's interesting. I had no idea that he did all this charitable stuff. All they talk about is gossip crap in the.
I know.
I had no idea. It was like really cool.
Yeah. He's done a lot of good stuff. But that, as you say, mainly interested in,
you know, whose girlfriend is or his wife or he's having marital problems. I mean, that's all they, I don't really watch news. I haven't watched news in like 35 years, I think. Yeah. But, you know, whenever you'd see a blurb, it's always like,
yeah,
which is why I don't watch news. But yeah, that's really cool. I had no idea.
Yeah.
Also, you were asked to write a tribute song for Nelson Mandela, which you did when you wrote The Messenger. Yeah. What did that overall experience mean to you? And did you take away any kind of life lessons from your meeting with him? Like, would you learn anything?
Well, you certainly learned that somebody once said to me, you've met Nelson Mandela, do you think he's genuine? And I thought that was the stupidest question I've ever been asked in my whole career. That's like, what? There's no way you can't be genuine to come out of prison.
Go to prison for, are you like, would he faking that? I mean.
And then come out and be this person. You won't be able to keep it up. It's just, so he was totally genuine. And what I found really fascinating was I was in South Africa, I was doing a concert, and I got a call saying, would you like to meet Nelson Mandela? And I thought, great, there's obviously going to be a whole stack of people there when I get there. But when I got there, it was just for the two of us. And but what I noticed was when I got out of the car, the atmosphere of his house just hit you. You could just feel like love. Everybody just absolutely loved him. It was just, you could cut it. It was tangible. It's quite incredible. I've never felt anything like that for anybody else. It was amazing. And I also went to Robben Island and met some of the people who looked after him, in inverted commas, who were desperate to be out looking after him now because they fell in love with him. Mm. He was able to change these people in the prison who were supposed to be looking after him, kind of keeping him in line. He was able to change their minds about how they should think. That's quite incredible because I don't think there's going to be lots of prison guards who are going to be changed by the prisoner.
No, no, that's not an open-minded, you know, given, you know, yeah, situation.
So that was amazing to meet somebody who had that kind of charisma. But, you know, I again, in Australia, I was in Australia, and I ordered some food, and the waitress brought the food, and she brought the food up, and she said, "Who's this for?" And I said, "Nobody special." And she said, "We're all special." And she's absolutely right. So although I meet Mr. Mandela and I think he's a very important for the world person, I also met Mr. Katharja, who was in prison with him, who was one of the other freedom fighters. And that was amazing, meeting him. So it's another special person. And then you'll meet somebody who, I don't know, looks after, fosters a whole load of children. Mm. And you think, that's an incredible person. You know, there's so many people who just do amazing things.
Yeah.
That in the end, there's no one person who's above everybody else. Because there's lots of people who are doing absolutely amazing things. Do you know what I'm saying?
I do. It's really cool that you think that way. That's really I agree with you. You know, everybody's got, like I said, we're all pretty similar. You know,
yeah. Everybody's got a special talent, and some people's special talent is just the capacity to love.
Yeah. Right. Right.
That's it. They've got no other discernible talent, if you like, but that capacity to love and be friendly and to be, you know, good to people. That's a huge thing.
That is huge. Yeah, because if everybody was like that, man, there'd be a lot less stress in the world, I'll tell you right now. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Just a few more questions.
I have to leave you in a few more questions because I've got to be in another appointment.
Two questions, and I really appreciate your time. You've been a doll. Biggest change in your personality over the last 10 years, and how much of that has been deliberate and how much is just a natural part of aging?
I was going to say biggest change is just getting older. That's it. We're all getting older. There's nobody, as soon as you're born, you're getting older. So that's
the truth.
The thing. Biggest change? I suppose one of the changes is that I suddenly realized, I think it was after the tour before this one, when I suddenly realized I love touring, but actually I don't think I want to be touring to the extent that I have been touring anymore. And I don't even remember it creeping up on me. I just remember, I just feel as if it just was like a realization all of a sudden that I love touring, but I don't want to be on the road for 18 months at a time anymore, or a year at a time, or 6 months at a time.
Sure.
And it just, that's quite interesting. I find it quite interesting to get to that stage, because I still love it and I want to cut down drastically, which I have done already.
Yeah.
The tour before this one was 18 months, and the tour before, and then the last tour was 3 months, I think it was 2 months, 3 months. So it's quite interesting to just realize that and to decide, okay, I'm going to do that. That's what I'm going to do. And I love touring, but I wanted to, since I realized it, I wanted to stop at a point of still really, really enjoying it.
Yeah,
not be on the road and think, oh, no, I don't want to be here. No, I don't want to get to that stage.
Totally get that. On your website, it says you love writing, and you said the same thing here a few minutes ago. You love writing songs. You'll never stop writing, but you're not going to tour as much. Do you think you'll this is Ricky's question, actually, by the way. Do you think you'll ever maybe devote more time to some other hobbies or business interests you have outside of music?
No, I don't think so. Because music is all consuming. I mean, I do different things every now and again, but music is it really. And it's one of those things that I kind of have to do. I think I'd be probably ill if I didn't do it.
Yeah.
So I have to do it.
Fair enough. Let me tell people where to find you online. And listen, I really can't thank you enough. You've been really lovely. I appreciate your thoughtfulness and your openness and your sincerity. And thank you so much for your time. It really meant a lot.
My pleasure.
Check out Joan. Her last album is Not Too Far Away. That's her latest record. You could find it on joanarmortrading.com, and there's a place where you could stream all her music on there. Support Joan's music. She's lovely, and she's been doing it a long time. And I you're very consistent, and I really appreciate it very much how genuine you are as far as what your purpose in life is and what is important to you, and that is, you know, putting out good stuff to others and just putting some love in the world. And I think we need more of that. Everybody needs more of that.
Yeah. So
thanks. Everybody, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed this interview, please share it on your social media channels. We appreciate your support. Subscribe to the podcast. Thanks very much to Joan Armour Trading for spending time with us. Please check her last record out and go to her website, joanarmortrading.com. It's Not Too Far Away. And check out her blues record. It's absolutely amazing. Into the Blues. And she got nominated for all sorts of awards, and she's kicking ass on guitar on that record. Make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com. Sign up to get on our newsletter list so you and I can connect. And most important, remember that happiness is a choice, so choose wisely. Be nice, go play your guitar, and have fun. Till next time, peace and love, everybody. I'm out. I hope you enjoyed this episode of Everyone Loves Guitar. If you did, make sure you go to everyonelovesguitar.com/subscribe and subscribe to the audio podcast and to our very active YouTube community. And if you have any comments, please write me at everyonelovesguitar.com/hello. We'll see you on the next episode. Until then, make sure you choose happiness, relax, and have as much fun as possible.